talks like an animal, talks like an animal, must be an animal, come hear the animal, talking animal, talking animal. Talks like an animal, must be an animal. Come hear the animals, talking animals, talking animals.
Good morning. This is Talking Animals on WMNF. I'm Duncan Strauss, and my guest today is Dr. Brenna Donnelly, the co-founder of Rescue Rebuild, an animal shelter renovation program that travels nationally, sometimes internationally, remodeling and renovating shelters in need. Since Donnelly launched Rescue Rebuild, the program has renovated more than 125 shelters. Recently, Donnelly began widening out these efforts with the formation of Safe Haven, which is devoted to creating housing for homeless people and domestic violence victims that can accommodate their pets. Later in the show, I'll speak with Kelly Van Neville of Heidi's Legacy Dog Rescue regarding a doggist, you heard me, adoption event happening in Tampa this Saturday, August 25th at the Pet Supermarket on North Dale Mabry Highway. Lastly, closer to the end of the program, when we play Name That Animal Tune, the prize will be a DVD copy of the acclaimed documentary Blackfish. Right now, though, let's get to Brenna with a reminder that I invite you to join the conversation by calling 813-239-9663, emailing dj at wmnf.org, or texting 813-433-0885. This is Dr. Brenna Donnelly on Talking Animals on WMNF. Good morning, Brenna.
Hi, how are you this morning?
Great. Thanks for joining us on Talking Animals. Great to have you here. So I'd like to start by discussing your academic and scientific background, which makes your story singular, I think. Of course, it's not unusual on this show for me to speak with someone who holds a PhD, but it is unusual, really, when that doctorate appears to have virtually nothing to do with the person's present-day work. So maybe if you would trace a bit of your path as a scientist and college professor.
Sure. So, yeah, it is an unusual series of events, I guess, that led us to this. But I was a very traditional science professor. I taught genetics, ecology, and ornithology, of all strange things, at a small school outside of Philadelphia called Delaware Valley University. And that's where Rescue Rebuild was really born. And I was very happy being a teacher, but this just spoke to my soul even more. And slowly but surely, I got brave enough to leave the academic world and take that leap of faith into the nonprofit world. So, yeah, it was great.
Well, you know, sort of untelescope that a little bit, I guess, just because I'm curious to know, what was your day-to-day life of academia like? Was it teaching classes, research, and writing, all the things that we would sort of imagine as a professor?
Yeah, it was a very small university. It was a teaching university, so we didn't do a lot of basic research. So my day in and day out life was in the classroom, working with students, and grading papers. That was probably the most dreary portion of that career. It was great.
Well, what things did you love most about being a professor in those days?
It really is the same things that I love now, empowering people to really reach their full potential. So then it was getting kids excited about science and really showing them that there's a lot more you can do in the world of animals other than just go and become a veterinarian. Not that there's anything wrong with that, but there are only so many veterinarian school openings. And so it was really neat to show kids that they could get into ecology. They could look at the animal world from a genetics and breeding perspective. And it was super exciting. So I loved that. But the kids were what really made it exciting for me. And so that's where, when we started Rescue Rebuild, how it kind of came to be. I was just doing animal, you know, kind of shelter projects with a friend of mine who got me hooked into it in West Virginia in a very small shelter. She was already down there doing some work for this shelter, quickly realized that they needed way more help, called me, conned me into coming down for a weekend to help while I was teaching. I took the weekend off, went down there, and it spun from there where we were spending every weekend there. And I would come back into the classroom with the very classic reversal of the dog ate my homework scenario and say, sorry that your papers aren't graded, but I was doing this really cool thing this weekend. And the kids were like, really? Can we come help? I was kind of shocked that they would, you know, unplug, detach from their phones and their technical life and come slum it with me in this little tiny, very, very small town in West Virginia and get dirty and really help the animals. But they loved it, and it just kind of exploded from there.
That's great. And just to follow up, just to touch more, though, on, we're going super fast here, and we got plenty of time to cover your story. So there are things you loved, but I'm wondering, were there things that you didn't love so much about being a professor? I mean, you said you didn't do that much research, so I'm guessing, unlike some who kind of end up having mixed feelings, I guess there was the publisher-parish element that maybe some professors feel mixed about. Were there some aspects that didn't appeal to you as much, and so you were maybe more open to making a change when all these other things came together?
Wow. So I would say the real turning point for me was in one of my last years teaching. I was asked to sit on a committee about committees. And I thought they were joking. My boss was joking with me when he actually said that, but I would, ask him, really? And he says, yes, we need to set term limits and we need to know how many people should be on it. And I mean, he was really serious. And I was like, this is actually a thing, a committee about committees.
Wow.
And that really, when you're in academia, that's really, you're either there for the love of research or you're there for the love of the kids or obviously, hopefully, a combination of both. But, sitting on committees is by far the dreariest part. I don't know how the deans do it and all of that. They sitting in an office every day, talking endless meetings. Not my thing. Committee for committees broke my,
So did the committee about committees decide, let's have some meetings about having fewer or more meetings? I mean, because that seemed like the natural extension of this, but.
It was absolutely what that was all about. Almost died of boredom about 100 times.
I'm sure.
That's really the least fun part about that, that whole career path. I loved research, but loved teaching more. I started in research, actually, and that was my passion. I missed being in the classroom, missed the social activity with the kids, and just having their enthusiasm keep me excited about academics.
Gotcha. Well, let me let folks know this is Talking Animals. I'm Duncan Strauss. If you just tuned in, my guest is Dr. Brenna Donnelly, the co-founder of Rescue Rebuild, an animal shelter renovation program that travels around this country and sometimes other countries, remodeling and renovating shelters in need. If you'd like to ask Brenna a question or offer a comment, please call 813-239-9663, email dj@wmnf.org, or text 813-433-0885. So how early in your life did you start loving and caring about animals? I'm going to guess that there was some history of this when the friend with the shelter nearby appealed to you to help out.
Oh, yeah. I grew up loving animals. One of my favorite stories that my mom loves to tell everybody is I was small, boy, probably maybe 6 or so, and we had gone apple picking, and I was mesmerized by squirrels. I would feed them everything I could. I always wanted to talk to them, play with them. I mean, I was obsessed with having a squirrel pet. Mom stepped out to go run some errands and go shopping and came back in, and I had opened all the windows in our house and was sitting on the dining room table feeding squirrels peanut butter and apples. And, of course, when she opened the door, the squirrels all, dispersed. And she, as you would expect any parent to do, clearly lost her mind.
Yeah.
And, told me to get those squirrels out of the house. But it was just, that was really just one of the funnier stories. But I spent my whole life trying to tame every animal that I could, play with every animal that I could, and it has just gotten collectively worse.
And in your family, were there more conventional animals, cats or dogs, alongside the squirrel contingent that you were attracted to?
Of course, yeah. We always had cats and dogs. We always, we had horses for a while. It was great. Just growing up being able to play with animals. I really don't understand how people feel like their house is a home without, at least one pet running around in there keeping it cuddly and wrapped.
So you are helping out at the shelter near the school. When did you first identify the need for a program that would indeed renovate older or under-equipped animal shelters. Was it this shelter itself that had some kind of element that needed that help that kind of helped spur this? Or?
Yeah, so the first shelter in West Virginia, my friend stumbled across, I believe, when she was on vacation. And she was there. She found dogs were chained out, staked out to just, you know, basically chained to the ground on a tether. They, you know, some of them had makeshift houses, but most of them just lived in this holler in West Virginia with absolutely no protection from the elements other than maybe a box that used to house a TV kind of a thing. It was really awful. And so, you know, she went down there and was trying to build dog houses, at least get the dogs some shelter. I mean, West Virginia is really cold in the winter, obviously. It's tons of snow. Yeah. And that was her thing. And she never had a background in construction. So she would bring family. And then she, you know, her and I got hooked up with this. And my dad and uncle built houses when I was growing up. My stepfather, you know, built his own sailboat. I grew up in a very, very handy house environment. And
okay.
So, you know, but construction, obviously, not my background. But I was a science dork.
Yeah.
So it was a change for me even. But thank God for YouTube and the internet because, you know, whatever you don't know, you can pick up there and then just asking, constantly asking questions. Thank goodness for that inquisitive science brain. But yeah, it really started with that one shelter. And we worked there for 2 years trying to get this shelter up to snuff, finally building enclosures, getting these dogs off chains, and just really making it at least, you know, somewhat hospitable for these, you know, the pets that came through there.
Yeah.
And other shelters in the local area around that one in West Virginia heard what we were doing, and we did another shelter in West Virginia. Then people near us in Pennsylvania, we're about an hour outside of Philadelphia. People around us started hearing what we were doing. The college students started getting involved. They wanted to do more. And it really started West Virginia and then locally to us in Philly, and that was around 2007. So we were, you know, beg, borrowing, and stealing everything we could. Construction workers would give us old fence. We would get things donated whenever we could, but we were, as we would call it, pretty ghetto fabulous back in the day. We were not the spit and polished organization that we are now.
So I'm sure some people listening are react as I was when you were describing that first shelter, and I'm wondering if there's others, at least in West Virginia and maybe as you moved into Philly. I mean, it's just hard to imagine that a place that's at least calling itself a shelter was chaining its dogs, having no protection from the elements. I mean, what was the situation there, or did either people just have either no idea and or no resources, or how was it that that kind of operation was considered a viable shelter?
I mean, it's that area of West Virginia in particular is not very rich in resource. It was in a very, very low populated area. And this is actually a rescue group that had started, and they were trying to help out, you know, just by pulling in dogs off the streets. There were dogs wandering and getting hit on the highway that ran, you know, not too far from the town. And so everybody always starts with obviously super good intentions.
Yeah.
It wasn't these people's intention to, you know, take these animals and having them kept in a way that we would, you know, almost consider inhumane, if not completely inhumane. It wasn't their intent at all. And that's, I mean, when you look at hoarding situations or you look at many animal welfare scenarios that, you know, kind of make you go, dear God, what were these people thinking?
Yeah.
They always start with great intention. And so it just kind of grew and got bigger than they could handle in their home, bigger than they could handle with the dog houses that they had available. It was all done at their home. It wasn't, you know, this wasn't a municipal shelter that was funded by the government. You know, it was, you know, just a mom and pop organization with a couple that were trying to do the right thing and just fell a bit short of the mark. And so
I see.
It's sad. Sad how many of those there are, actually.
Well, it really sounds like they were doing the best they could under the circumstances, because I guess that was part of what struck me is that this wasn't that many years ago. So it was just sort of jarring, I guess, to hear about when you think of a shelter. I mean, as we know, and as you can probably speak to better than anyone, there's quite a range of what constitutes a shelter and what kind of condition they're in and what kind of facilities they offer, et cetera. But it just still was, you know, kind of a little, you know, surprising to hear about, again, all these, just picturing all these dogs chained out there. And again, like as you say, with West Virginia winters and other things, I just thought, wow, this is kind of surprising. I mean, this...
Yeah. I mean, the best thing that came out of it is, you know, after bringing so many students there and us going down there, I mean, oh my goodness, the number of friends, family, students, and just anybody we knew that we could be like, hey, got a really cute dog for you. And we would just bring it up. One of my best friends, oh my goodness, this little dog, we had just gotten there for a build, and this little dog, like, stops, stares at me, and does this, like, military belly crawl as far as it could on its little chain. And I was like, oh, do I have the human for you, buddy. Brought the dog home, didn't even ask my friend. Showed up in her classroom. She was a fellow teacher. Showed up in her classroom. She was like, oh, my goodness, is this your new dog? I was like, no, it's your new dog. And so, yeah, we were taking as many dogs out of that place as we could just to get them to a number that maybe they could care for more.
Yeah, more manageable.
And humanely.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, you know, that's kind of how all of this, you know, all of these shelters that you hear of that really, you know, get themselves kind of sideways and into these situations that are untenable, you know, they start small and dogs seem to show up.
Yeah, it's an inevitable thing sometimes with just the sheer steady avalanche of animals that that don't have homes and do need homes. And so when you did that first shelter there and then some others in West Virginia and then moved into Philly, were there any other organizations anywhere, other parts of the country even, that you knew of that performed similar services at that time?
We were probably about, I believe, probably 5 years in, and we heard of another organization, Project Positive, and they are an amazing group out of New England that does a similar type of thing. But they were all professional construction workers and contractors. One is an electrician. One builds amazing million-dollar homes. And they do, you know, they were only doing like one project a year because obviously they had very busy lives. They didn't have the luxury of being a professor and having every January and spring break and summer off to go do these cool projects.
Yeah.
And so they did one. They came down and actually did one with us over, you know, as soon as the school semester got out. We partnered with them in a job we did in Eastern Tennessee. And now they still do projects all the time. But they have to be smaller scale just because, you know, they actually have productive careers, unlike me with my slacker summer.
So Project Positive still going, but like you say, kind of with a more limited approach. And then have there been others that have cropped up that have heard about what you've done or even what Project Positive done and said, hey, you know, what a great idea. Maybe we can take this portion of the country or do something similar because we have those kind of construction skills ourselves?
You know, I have not seen any. Every once in a while, you'll see some strange thing pop up on the Discovery Channel. You know, we used to be in a very back kind of handed way affiliated with Discovery Channel when we were sponsored by Petfinder. But, you know, so we always wonder, did they get that idea from us? But who knows? I don't know of any other organization, and certainly not to the level that we do with as many projects that we do every year.
Yeah. And so I know that Rescue Rebuild operates under the umbrella of Greater Good. Can you briefly explain Greater Good and then describe how that works with Rescue Rebuild, like just that sort of structure?
Connection? Sure. So Rescue Rebuild was a standalone nonprofit for years, and we had amazing, amazing financial support from Greater Good and the Animal Rescue Site. They were always so, so, so good to us financially, supporting us through social media, supporting us financially. They were just amazing, amazing to us. And in 2015, before then, they had started asking us, you know, if we would come on board with them, and it was, you know, I wasn't really ready to give up that freedom. I thought, oh gosh, what's this going to look like? You know, we've been running our own show for so long and doing it so well. But frankly, just, you know, I want to build. I want to play with animals. I want to get out there and meet people and see how we can help and get people excited about volunteerism. And the idea of doing my taxes every year and payroll and insurance and all of that and just does not appeal to me. And they were more than happy to take that off my hands. So in 2015, after years of supporting us, we folded under them and became part of the Greater Good family.
Okay. So you're under that umbrella, but you're still, mm-hmm. as I understand it at least, kind of operating much like you had before, although you've handed over some of the responsibilities, or at least maybe some of the chores that you were probably all too happy to hand over.
All too happy. Yeah, I mean, the really neat thing about Greater Good is that they have all these what we call signature programs where, you know, the executive director, Liz Baker, she would be the best headhunter ever. She goes out and she finds these amazing groups doing great things in the world, whether it's for pets or for humans or environmental programs. She finds groups doing cool things and says, how can we help you do an even better job? And, you know, that was my answer was, hey, if I can not have to waste time, in my mind, doing all this admin stuff, I could do even more. We could expand the program and do even greater things in the world of animal welfare. And she does that for all sorts of other organizations. So, yeah, there's tons that Greater Good does. And it's all kind of run the same way. So we maintain, you know, she doesn't micromanage us. Amazing. So, yeah, we still run as we did, but we've been allowed to expand and do a lot. We were doing, you know, 3 to 5 builds a year then. I mean, in the last 3 years since we've been with them, we've been able to do, I think last year we did 15 or somewhere.
Wow.
11 to 15 a year now, kind of where we're sitting.
So, wow, that is quite a difference for sure.
Yeah, huge.
Well, again, this is Talking Animals with Duncan Strauss. My guest is Dr. Brenna Donnelly, a founder of Rescue Rebuild, an animal shelter renovation program that travels around the country and beyond, remodeling and renovating shelters in need. So far, they've renovated over 125 shelters. We invite you to join the conversation by calling 813-239-9663, emailing DJ at WMNF.org, or text 813-433-0885. Once word further spread beyond just the immediate West Virginia sort of Philly base that Rescue Rebuild was doing this, I imagine at least that it didn't take long before you were flooded with requests from shelters to remodel or spruce up their facility. How does that work? How does a shelter apply to be considered for that opportunity?
Super easy. If you just go to rescuerebuild.org, you'll land on our webpage and you will see right across our banner is Get Involved. And so you can sign up there to be one of our volunteers, or you can go there and fill out an application for a renovation grant.
Well, it sounds super simple, but for a while, at least for the bulk of your time, you're doing 3 to 5 a year. So now you've kicked that up, which is nice. But still, I'm going to guess that there are probably a good number of shelters applying relative to the number that you can actually do, at least in a given year. So what criteria do you and others there use in choosing who will get the Rescue Rebuild treatment?
So, yeah, there are about 14,000 animal groups in the U.S. So, yes, we have barely scratched the surface for sure. Our biggest criteria, I would say, sadly, because we take donor responsibility so seriously, you know, the people sending us, you know, $5 at a time, $10 at a time. And, you know, a lot of these people probably could put that money to really good use in their own lives. So we super appreciate what they do and take it very seriously. So when we look at shelters, we're looking at where can we get the most impact on our donor dollars. So sadly, we do have some restrictions. If the property is not actually owned by an organization, so a lot of those mom and pop rescues that the rescue is run out of somebody's home, unfortunately, get excluded because you never know if it's owned by somebody and I put $50,000 into it to, you know, help them make their shelter or rescue a better place, then, you know, maybe they retire in a year, maybe they sell their property. You know, we need to select shelters that just have a little bit more of a stable business model. So the property has to be owned by the organization. And we do. We look for impact. You know, where are we going to be able to affect the most change in animals, in many animals' lives? So we tend to prefer the larger municipal and larger private shelters just because they're doing the bulk of the work in their area and, you know, often are doing so with very limited budgets. So that's usually our preference, but very small shelters in the past. So it really is all about, you know, who's doing great things and how can we help them do even better work.
So I assume that in terms of the owning the property thing, which sounds like it's critical to you guys, that as part of that, I'm guessing the organization would need to be a 501c3, because the example you gave of the mom and pops, who at least in some cases would of course own their property, but you're saying that's a little bit too risky just because there's so many variables as to what would happen to them and therefore the property and therefore the shelter. So I assume that probably these two qualify as not only that they own the property, but they are a 501c3.
Yeah, either a full-on 501c3 nonprofit or the municipal shelters, of course, the city-run shelters and county-run shelters are not 501s, but they fall into their own category of numbering that the IRA creatively comes up to that I can never remember. But yeah,
right.
They're a government shelter. We definitely love to do those. We do a lot more government shelters than we do private, it seems, these days, because they seem to be doing the bulk of the work. I mean, not to besmirch any of the privates, because good Lord, what would we do without them?
Right.
So again,
speaking of money and investments and things that you guys have to decide, like, is this where we should put our resources and what's it going to translate to and what kind of impact is it going to have? What expenses does the shelter itself face in the rescue rebuild process?
It really depends. The vast majority of the rescues and shelters that we help have no financial contribution to our job. Obviously, that limits the number of projects that we can do. So we love it when we hear of organizations who, have gotten to a capital campaign and they have, $150,000 of, let's say, a $200,000 project, and we can help not only close that gap by going and doing some of the work and bringing the cost of the project down, but also just helping them meet their goals. So we love it when we can help organizations that already have some skin in the game, so to speak. The vast majority have no financial contribution.
Wow. Okay. Well, let's get one of our callers involved. Hi, you're on Talking Animals with Dr. Brenda Donnelly.
Hi, John Flaherty calling from Sarasota.
Hi, John.
Hi. I have an innovation that I've come across that reflects all the sun's energy off the roofs of chicken coops or dog kennels or any surface that's coated with the calcite crystal doesn't allow the space underneath it to warm up. And I was wondering if heat stress with global warming is a problem at shelters that your guest comes in contact with.
Warming, whether it's global or otherwise, it's just an huge problem for animal shelters, especially, Florida is just, it struggles so much. All of the Gulf Coast, we do a ton of work down there. And so what we see is that heat trapping, like you're speaking of, and then the other problem that comes along with that is the humidity and the fungal skin diseases. And so lots of our projects and builds focus around, okay, what can we do to help a shelter really keep these dogs healthier? We're always keeping disease management in mind for any of our projects. And the fungal skin diseases in the Gulf Coast are out of control. We actually sometimes will go in and recommend that while these big fancy shelters with their incredibly expensive HVAC systems are great, obviously in a perfect world, but for smaller shelters that can't handle that burden of just upkeep, even if we paid for all of the construction, just managing those HVAC bills and those electric bills would bankrupt them. And so we have been working with a lot of shelters to consider open air. So you can do open air sheltering where it's basically what looks like a pavilion, and then the dogs are out there, the wind is blowing, you can actually put big commercial fans in above them. Some of the shelters will do partial exterior walls but leave the top, maybe 4 feet completely open so that air moves through there. Heat's a huge problem.
Thank you, caller, for your call.
Thank you. Keep up the good work.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So, Brenna, I guess you've been doing this for the better part of a dozen years, right? Do I have that right?
Yeah.
So is there a prototypical rescue rebuild project or shelter at this point?
Oh, golly. No, we have done, oh my goodness, the things that we find when we get to shelters and you think it's going to be just a simple, straightforward, hey, we're going to pull, some old junky kennels out and we're going to, rebuild them, or just fix the chain link or repaint or, strip a floor. It's like an old house. It's like you open up a wall and you realize that there's a lot more than when you first expected when you got there. So no, I mean, we've come to become, I wouldn't say experts because we struggle every day with the new weird things we see, but experts in problem solving and figuring things out. I could tell you what one of our favorite things to do.
By all means.
Would be our cat room. Oh my goodness. If you go on our Rescue Rebuilds Facebook page and you see some of the cat rooms, we just did one in Pensacola, Florida in January, and it was, I mean, the cat room was this dreary little dungeon. It was a two-sided dungeon. We knocked out the wall in this two-sided space and made this beautiful, colorful cat adoption space that people can go in and, you know, just really enjoy spending time with the animals. And so any project that we can do that would encourage families to go and spend time at shelters, whether it's adopting an animal or just volunteering and spending time socializing dogs, socializing cats, and just making them feel loved, even if they can't bring them into their own home. So anything we can do to a shelter to make it fun and exciting and really colorful that you would be like, I'll bring my 8-year-old here. They're not going to need therapy for the rest of their lives if they see this place now.
Yeah.
is a win for us. We love, love, love those projects.
Yeah, no, it's really true. And sort of coincidentally, this morning on Facebook, I posted a before and after of that very cat room, the Pensacola cat room, on the Talking Animals radio show page, my personal page, and a WMNF bulletin board page. So if anybody's listening and is online or has access to a computer, they can quickly see the what Brenda is talking about. And yeah, you could really understand what you're saying because, I mean, just look at those two side by side. And it's true that if you're a kid or an adult and you go into some of these places and it is super dreary and super depressing, it's a tough experience. But yeah, if you look at the after in the Pensacola cat room, for example, you think, wow, I'd like to hang out here even if I'm fully adopted on cats or whatever, just because it just seems like a pretty neat, festive place to be.
It's so true. And that's the thing, too. And when you think of one of the biggest problems in the sheltering side of animal welfare, you know, we have what we call compassion fatigue. And so these people go to work every day and, you know, it's such an abuse to your happiness, you know, because you see all these animals, you wish they were on somebody's couch instead of in a kennel or in a cat cage. And just every day they have to go there and it never ends, you know. So you get, you know, a handful, a batch of dogs or cats out and then somebody's flooding in behind there. And so it's a never ending battle of just mental and emotional exhaustion. And so anything we can do to these shelters to make it better for the staff there too and try to keep them as upbeat and happy to go to work every day as possible is a win in my book too.
Now, over those dozen years or so, have you worked on a shelter more than once?
You know, sometimes we do. It's
okay.
Strange. So we don't like to. I mean,
yeah.
Not that we don't like to. We love these people become family to us. After you spent 2 weeks of, you know, 16-hour days working in their shelter, they really are family at that
yeah.
point. And so we're always happy to go back, but there's so many shelters in need that, you know, it's hard for us to justify it. So normally when it has happened, it's more for, we do a lot of corporate jobs as well. So, you know, Mars Pet Care is one of our big sponsors, and they have an amazing employee outreach program. They call it their Mars Volunteer Program. And so we spend a lot of time in Nashville helping them facilitate projects for this Mars Volunteer Program.
I see. Okay.
And so we've been to Nashville's Metro Animal Care and Control a bunch of times, but it's not because, you know, it's just a convenience to that sponsor. And if they're willing to give us bodies and money to go help animals, of course, the answer is going to be yes. That's why.
Yeah, absolutely. I understand. And speaking of bodies, like, what is the core constituency of the Rescue Rebuild troops that travels from shelter to shelter? How many people are there? And I imagine it expands or declines with certain numbers, depending on where you're going and the shelter itself, I guess, can provide by way of volunteer help.
Yeah, so we do. We have a core group. So like I said, you can go to our website. Sign up to be a volunteer. We'll send you information. You know, sometimes we're really good about doing it. Sometimes we're terrible. So don't be shy. If you haven't heard from us, just reach out and, you know, knock on our heads with those emails. But while we do travel with a certain number of people, maybe we bring 5 to 10 with us on every project just to have a core body of humans. Mm-hmm. We much prefer to recruit locally. You know, the beauty of what we do is getting people up off the couch, getting them into the shelter, and realizing that, sure, you may not have money to donate. You always can carve out some time.
Yeah.
You know, unplug from that TV and that computer for an hour a week, you know, and get into your shelter. And even if it's just to go pet a cat, that cat's day is going to be infinitely better if it gets to get out of a cage and get some cuddle time, get some play time. And the same for the dogs. If you can take them out and walk them if they have the availability to do that, or get them out into a play yard and play with them, that dog is going to be so much more mentally well adjusted that its ability to get adopted is going to increase exponentially. So, you know, giving time, we have a really cool stat that we use when we're trying to extol the virtues of volunteerism. If every single person between the ages of 10 and 70 years old was to go out and just volunteer 1 8-hour day of their year, that would be the full-time equivalent of every single brick-and-mortar shelter in the United States being able to hire 60 full-time employees.
Wow.
Can you imagine what every shelter could do with 60 additional full-time employees? One day.
Yeah, no, that's
a couch, go give one day.
That's a pretty staggering statistic. Yeah, I'm sure that's quite effective to rally the troops that are on the couch. But so we're just in our final couple moments, but I do want to squeeze in a couple other things. And one is, I gather that recently you've been widening out really the rescue rebuild efforts with this offshoot, if that's the right way to describe it, called Safe Haven. Yeah. So this brushes up against an area that is very important to me. I've done shows about it and written about it. So it's the immense challenge for victims of domestic violence to seek refuge at a shelter if they have pets, because most shelters across the country still now can't accommodate pets. So maybe you could talk a little about the Safe Haven program, what it does and what it's seeking to do.
Sure. So, you know, we were plugging along very happily in our animal sheltering world, and a partner of ours that we had worked with had been doing some work with kenneling dogs that had come in with people who had been victimized by domestic violence. And they shared with me a statistic that nearly 50% of the women who are abused delay leaving these abusive situations because they're afraid to leave a pet behind. And when I heard that 50% of the women are experiencing this, I cried. I was like, are you kidding me? This is such an easy fit. So, you know, if we can bring what we've learned in the world of animal sheltering, you know, more durable building products, making things super pet friendly, and providing things to keep dogs and cats mentally happy so they don't destroy your property, you know, we can do these things at shelters. And so, yeah, we started with domestic violence shelters and are now expanding into homeless shelters as well. And we'd like to even further expand that into providing pet-friendly veterans housing.
So, wow, that's
yes,
great.
It's extremely needed, and we're very, very excited to get going on it.
Yeah, no, it does seem both like a sort of natural evolution of rescue rebuild, and yet like such a hugely critical need. Like you say, the statistics, preparing a piece that I wrote about it, sometimes I think it's even worse or more severe than the 50% number. But either way, the fact that people just won't leave their pets until they know there's a safe place they can take them, and just people are staying in abusive situations in the meantime. So just that alone, much less homeless folks and veterans as well being helped. So that's fantastic. So we're just about out of time, Brenna, but I do, I'm unfortunately going to need to have you respond briefly, but I do have been sort of cued to ask you about winning a Rescue Hero of the Year award. And I don't know if you can guess who cued me, but...
Sure. Is that my buddy Claudia?
It says disclaimer, I am the proud mama, so...
Oh, my mom. Oh, my goodness. Yes, she is the proud mama.
There you go.
Yeah, so one of our corporate sponsors wanted to do this insane project where they wanted to do a shelter renovation in each of the contiguous United States. So we did 48 shelters in 5 months. It was the craziest 5 months of my life, but we pulled it off, And yes, on the Fox show, it was called Cause for Pause then. I don't know what it's called now. They changed the name. I won Hair of the Year award for that.
That's great. Rightly so. And congratulations, belated or otherwise, but that's terrific. So we've been speaking with Dr. Brenna Donnelly. Again, the organization is called Rescue Rebuild. The website is rescuerebuild.greatergood.org to find out more about how you can get involved and volunteer, and if you have a shelter that you think might use their help, and get involved with applying for their assistance in that way. So, Brenna, thank you so much for joining us today on Talking Animals. Thanks for all your great work on behalf of all those shelters and therefore all the animals in them.
Thank you for what you do, Duncan. I appreciate it.
All right, thank you. Later on the show, we'll speak with Kelly Van Nevel of Heidi's Legacy Dog Rescue about a major adoption event happening in Tampa this Saturday. Right now, though, it's time to step into the Comedy Corner for a piece from Joe Zimmerman that may stretch the definition of animal comedy. In fact, it's a part of a piece called Bigfoot Enthusiast from Joe Zimmerman, today's Comedy Corner on Talking Animals on WMNF.
My buddy's a Bigfoot enthusiast. His name's Dave. He's a real person. He called me. He goes, "Big news in the Bigfoot community." I was like, "Go on." Because I am a Bigfoot enthusiast. He goes, "Joe, we found adolescent Bigfoot tracks. They're breeding." Okay, so did you find little big feet? You found regular footprints, didn't you, Dave? Shut up, Joe. You'll see. They always go, "You'll see," like we're gonna find Bigfoot, and then I'll be like, "No, I was wrong. I should have been searching too." What an idiot. No, if we find Bigfoot, I'm gonna be pumped, you're gonna be pumped, everybody's gonna be pumped except for Bigfoot enthusiasts who just lost their hobby. We got him. Sasquatch is ours. Now what? Oh man, I don't have a job. I don't have no family. They left. I'm not that into chupacabras. I've tried. Maybe we should go ahead and kill Bigfoot. Keep this enthusiasm alive.
That was Joe Zimmerman with a portion of a piece called Bigfoot Enthusiast, taken from his album titled Smiling at Wolves. Now on to Kelly Van Nevel of Heidi's Legacy Dog Rescue to hear about the adoption event taking place this Saturday. This is Kelly Van Nevel on Talking Animals on WMNF. Good morning, Kelly.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us on Talking Animals.
Thank you for having us.
So first, maybe you could just give a very brief overview of Heidi's Legacy Dog Rescue. I mean, right off the bat, it's kind of unusual for a rescue to have legacy in its name. So maybe you could kind of explain that and also just what the general mission of Heidi's is.
Yeah, Heidi's was established in 2002 when our founder, who just recently passed away from cancer, she had been going through chemotherapy and found a dog on the side of the road, and she named her Heidi. And she helped her through her chemo and her first round of cancer, and then Heidi literally died the day after she was told that she was cancer-free. So she decided to, and she was a German Shepherd, and so Lori decided to name the rescue after her.
Nice. Okay, well, certainly a great ongoing tribute. So basically a rescue, and this is a special event this coming Saturday, but just generally people can find dogs to adopt there on just a regular basis, correct?
Yeah, we actually, all of our dogs are in foster homes. All of our dogs are on our website also.
Okay. And that website is what?
It's HeidisLegacyDogRescue.com.
Okay. All right. Sounds straightforward. So let's talk a little bit about this Saturday's event. I mean, it sort of comes on the heels of the big national Clear the Shelters initiative. How many dogs will be available for adoption? And give us some of the details of where, when, and other aspects of the event.
So we're gonna have hopefully between 15 and 20 dogs at the event. Every time we seem to put a dog up on the website, it seems they go very quickly. We do a adoption, a contract, and also we have everybody fill out an application. So, and we're just really excited to be included in this event this weekend. It should be, we're hoping for great success, and also with the partnership we're working with Invisible Fence.
Sure. So let's talk a little bit more specifically before we get on anything else about the details. So it's, again, this Saturday, August 25th, it's at Pet Supermarket, if I'm not mistaken, on the North Dale Mabry Highway in Tampa. Okay.
It's north of the inner, off 75 on Dale Mabry, yeah.
Right. And it runs, the event runs from 10 a.m. to 3 p.m., right?
Yes, it does. Yep.
Yeah. And here's the thing. So we don't normally talk about costs and adoption fees or what the, at least what they ordinarily would be. But we can mention that they're waived, if I understand correctly, this Saturday, right?
Invisible Fence is actually covering a portion of each dog adopted at the event. They're not paying the full adoption donation, but they're going to cover portions of whatever dogs are adopted at the event.
That's great. So again, if you've been thinking about getting a dog, adopting a dog, and you want to head out this Saturday, sounds like there'll be a nice array to choose from, and that your adoption fee will be greatly reduced over what it otherwise would be. So sounds like you really can't afford not to go.
Right. Especially if you're looking for a new forever friend.
Yeah, exactly. So that's cool. Well, this sounds really, really great. And anything else we should know about this Saturday's event, Kelly?
We're also going to have some food trucks there for people also to stop and have an eat. Also, they're volunteering their time because of the rescue, which is nice. But we're really excited, and we hope to have a lot of people show up and be interested in our dogs. They're really excited about looking for their forever homes too, and that way we can save more for more. The more they get adopted, the more we can save.
Sure. Now, have you done events comparable at least to this in terms of scope in the past?
We have worked with other rescues where big events. We've done some with animal-based charities. They usually run big events for the Tampa Bay area for all rescues. We've done Oktoberfest and things like that. We've done Gulfport Get Rescued, which is a great event down in South St. Pete.
Sure.
So we do have events that we do participate in a lot, yes.
Okay, so I just was wondering if you had a track record based on that to guess how many of the dogs that you'll have out on Saturday would likely be adopted, but it sounds like you can sort of approximate, but there isn't a direct past experience with this kind of adoption event.
That's a really good question. It just depends on, a lot of times it's about meeting the dog and the people. So sometimes people get a feeling right away, so that's making sure both parties are get along. That's the big thing. And so sometimes you might see a dog online, but when you meet the dog, you or the dog may not be may not mesh well.
Right.
So they might see a different dog at the event. So that's nice because we're going to have so many there. We're going to have puppies up to adult dogs. So
nice.
There's going to be a nice ratio of different types of animals there. And different types of breeds too. We'll have German Shepherds. We'll have some Chihuahuas. We'll have some Dachshunds. We have all kinds of different dogs in our rescue.
A dog for every occasion, I think we could say.
Yes.
So very cool, yes. Kelly. Well, thanks for joining us on Talking Animals and filling us in. And we look forward to seeing people out again this Saturday at Pet Supermarket on North Dale Mabry Highway, again from 10 a.m. to 3 p.m. So whatever you got going that day, you've got like 5 hours to scoot by and see some, cool dogs and adopt one, hopefully. So thanks again.
No, thanks for having us.
You bet. Coming up at 11 on WNF, it's Robert Lori and Radioactivity, kicking off a three-hour block of interviews, phone calls, news, and more, including in the noon hour. Midpoint with Nola Lalay, then at 1 p.m., John Gilmore presides over executive session. Then the music kicks back in at 2 p.m. with Scott Elliott in the All Souls edition of It's the Music. We have just about reached the end of today's edition of Talking Animals, but next week my guest will be Dr. Carrie Krieger, the founder of Save the Frogs, which bills itself as the world's leading amphibian conservation organization. Also, I invite you to visit talkinganimals.net for audio archives of every show we've ever broadcast. iTunes podcasts are available there too. There are also links to the Facebook page, our Twitter feed, and more. Please like us on Facebook, the show, and or me personally, and follow me on Twitter. You can also subscribe to our e-newsletter to find out about our guests a couple of days beforehand and other news from the Talking Animals world. That's all found at talkinganimals.net. I'm Duncan Strauss. Thanks very much for listening. Have a good week. Be kind to animals, kind to others. Be kind to yourself. This is Talking Animals on WMNF, Tampa, Brandon, Clearwater, Largo, Weeki Wachee, and beyond. The last local radio station in Tampa Bay. NPR News headlines coming up, and then Rob Lori with Radioactivity. Thanks for listening. Talk to you next Wednesday on Talking Animals on WMNF.